Welcome to this Thursday edition of the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm your host, Lori Boyer. In today's show, Taylor Charlstrom will be discussing a new machine learning model that can detect whether or not a pesticide is toxic to honeybees. And I'll have a look at regional and national agricultural news, beginning with regional ag news right after this.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
According to the USDA National Agricultural Statistics Service California Crop Progress and Condition Report, last week, average lows for California ranged from 51 to 68 degrees along the coast, 51 to 59 in the mountains, 59 to 71 in a valley, and 60 to 80 degrees in a desert. Average highs for the state range from 66 to 103 along the coast, 83 to 95 in the mountains, 101 to 111 in the desert, and 100 to 108 in the Central Valley. In the fruit crops, stone fruit harvest was well underway last week. Peach, nectarine, and plum harvest remained steady. Irrigation continued to reduce heat stress. Raisin grape varieties steadily developed. Various table grape varieties were harvested. Persimmons, kiwi fruits, Asian pears, grapefruits, and lemons continued to develop. Some kiwi orchards were shaded to protect the fruit from burning. Pomegranates matured, and producers expect harvest to begin soon. Olives continued to develop. And in the nut crops, almond harvest was well underway. Weed spraying and orchard cleanup continued in preparation for harvest. Walnut and pistachio development continued as well. In the vegetable crops last week in Stanislaus County, tomato harvest continued and harvested fields were disced. Garlic was harvested and placed in bins to dry. Sweet corn was sprayed for earworms. In Tulare County, sweet corn, peppers, okra, salad greens, herbs, onions, tomatoes, and other vegetables were harvested and sold at local stands and markets. The new very early generation of ARRA grape varieties launched at recent field days in California has seen big interest from growers around the world, with even more varieties set to be launched at the second field day planned for later in the month. The new varieties are under the new prefix named ARD, ARD 35, ARD 37, ARD 41, and ARD 42. They are all very early to ripening grapes. Following the very positive response regarding the early ARRA field day back in July, the attendees expressed their interest in planting the very early ARRA selections that were showcased, and they are pleased with the outcome. They received substantial interest, especially from producers in Egypt and Australia, according to Nomi Carniel Padan, Commercial Director of Grappa. The first field day on July 14th was held at the ARRA breeding program site in Bakersfield. It was the first time in over 3 years that the Grappa team could be reunited in person after the pandemic. Visitors from many countries gathered to see the commercial as well as very early and early ARRA table grape varieties. Chatcher Carniel, ARRA varieties breeder, welcomed the guests with an opening speech saying that, as we all know, the world of fresh produce is unpredictable. Ever-changing climate patterns can leave producers with uncertainty regarding the harvesting time and endurance of the fruit. The program offers producers very early and mid-season varieties that can adapt to extreme weather conditions, ranging from extreme heat to cold and heavy rain. During the vineyard tour, attendees had the chance to see the very exciting, usually early mid variety, the red ARD 35. The selection is not among the very early, but this year, the weather advanced a ripening time. ARD 35 colors naturally and reaches a beautiful bright red color. It is crunchy, firm, and sweet, and gives good yield and is easy to grow. The crunchiness and flavor resemble those of an apple. This variety is an ideal continuation of the ARRA Passion Fire. One of the stars this year was the ARD 42, a new very early red variety. Bearing extreme crunch, sweetness, and fertility, it ripens at the same time as early sweet. The next set of field days will be on August 22nd and 23rd. Jill Moran, a longtime Monterey Mushrooms teammate, rejoined the sales team as a sales manager based out of Watsonville. Moran will manage fresh mushroom sales for retail and food service customers in the western region. She is responsible for the sales of mushrooms grown, packed, and shipped from its farms in Royal Oaks and Morgan Hill, which grow, harvest, and pack conventional, organic, white, baby Bella, and portobello mushrooms. For the past 3 years, Moran has been the operations manager at the Monterey Mushrooms Royal Oak Farm. No stranger to mushroom sales, Moran has 15 years of experience in customer service. She says she looks forward to reconnecting with customers and helping them to grow their mushroom category. As a result of cutbacks and sailings to the Port of Oakland, Blue Diamond almond growers are supporting two new rail services transporting almond exports from Central California to the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. On July 4th, Blue Diamond partnered with Union Pacific and ocean carrier CMA CGM to inaugurate a rail service from the Port of Oakland's Union Pacific ramp to terminals at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. This is in addition to a UP rail service from Fowler, California, in the southern part of the San Joaquin Valley that is transporting containerized almonds and dairy products to the Southern California ports, also in partnership with CMA CGM. Blue Diamond says a rail service could move as much as 1 billion pounds of almonds via the so-called Almond Express. In a recent interview for the FreshPlaza.com website, Steve Schult, Vice President of Global Supply Chain at Blue Diamond Growers, says that the new rail service has been supported by the California Department of Food and Agriculture Secretary Karen Ross, Undersecretary Birdsong, and D.D. Myers, Director of the Governor's Office of Business and Economic Development. Schult also cited the support of Eugene Soroka, Executive Director at the Port of Los Angeles. He said the two rail services transport about 400 containers per week to the Southern California ports. He said the cost to truck container to the Southern California ports from the San Joaquin Valley was $3,900 per container compared to about $1,900 per container by rail, but there's also an added $1,100 trucking charge, which brings the total cost to $3,000 per container. He said that $1,100 truck charge cost to Oakland from the San Joaquin Valley was seemingly the cheaper route, but problems with cutbacks of Port of Oakland vessel services and Oakland terminal unreliability had prompted Blue Diamond to transport some of the containers by rail. He said an initial rail service from Fowler, California to the Southern California ports prompted the interest in the rail. He said the initial rail service from Fowler, California to the Southern California ports prompted the interest in a rail. He said it was an existing vein that already was transporting dairy products and now is also transporting almonds. So there's an almond dairy rail connection to the Port of Los Angeles. He said they have a good partnership with Union Pacific.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit Phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
Researchers in the Oregon State University College of Engineering have harnessed the power of a branch of artificial intelligence known as machine learning to help protect bees from pesticides. Corey Simon, an assistant professor of chemical engineering, and Jowly Fern, assistant professor of computer science, led the project, which involved training a machine learning model to predict whether any proposed new herbicide, fungicide, or insecticide would be toxic to honeybees based on the compound's molecular structure. Simon explained a bit about the origins of the project.
There was a data set that was curated by folks, and you can imagine like an Excel spreadsheet with two columns. And each row is a bee toxicity experiment. And the first column shows you what's the pesticide molecule that was exposed to the bees. And the second column is what's the toxicity outcome, toxic or not. And with this data set, so our research is in using machine learning to predict the properties of molecules. We thought, oh, we can use a machine learning model to predict if a pesticide is toxic to bees. And instead of coding up an algorithm with explicit rules like, oh, if the molecule has this functional group, it's toxic, et cetera. What's neat about machine learning is you can show it that spreadsheet of examples, and it can find patterns in those molecules and try to figure out which patterns are correlated to pesticide toxicity. And then the idea is, once you have a new pesticide and you want to know if it's toxic or not, you input it to the model. So you show it to the model, and that model outputs a prediction of if it's toxic or not.
The good thing about the machine learning model is it can actually speed up the process of detecting toxicity in a pesticide compared to the traditional method.
You figure out what is the dose required to kill 50% of a population of bees after a certain amount of time. And if that dose exceeds a threshold value, then you declare it as toxic. And these toxicity experiments can be very expensive and time consuming. And so what's nice about our machine learning model is that you can input a hypothetical pesticide molecule into our model, and it will predict if it's toxic or not within a matter of seconds. And so that can save a lot of time, and it also can increase your throughput. So on the computer, we can sift through millions of possible pesticide molecules and predict if they're toxic or not. So it's our model sort of serves as a surrogate for a bee toxicity experiment. Now, of course, if you have a new pesticide molecule and you're about to start using it on a field, then you're not going to trust our model because it's not perfect. It's going to get some of them wrong inevitably. That's all machine learning models. And so the ground truth is a bee toxicity experiment that you would do in real life. But there's whole efforts to design effective, for example, insecticides on the computer by figuring out what kind of molecules can most readily bind with, say, a binding pocket in a protein that's a target in an insect. And on the computer, they might screen through millions of pesticide molecules like I'm talking about. And our model can be used to augment that to sort of further downscreen or filter pesticide molecules that are effective insecticides, but not harmful to bees.
Simon said the machine learning model would be most applicable with screening methods on a computer, but could also be used in emergency situations, as well as not just for bees, but other insect species as well.
Let's say that there's some pests coming to invade a field, and they need to quickly decide among a few pesticides which ones to use. You don't have time for a bee toxicity experiment. And so you could use our model in that emergency situation. Yeah, and also I think there's so many different species out there where you want to predict the toxicity to them. You might want to target a mite, but not a bee. And you could use our model to sort of downfilter pesticides you want to test on mites that aren't harmful to bees, for example.
These findings using the machine learning model are important because many fruit, nut, and vegetable crop seeds rely on bee pollination. Without bees to transfer the pollen needed for reproduction, almost 100 commercial crops in the United States would vanish. Bees' global economic impact is annually estimated to exceed $100 billion as well. For My Ag Life, I'm Taylor Chalstrom.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns on September 28th and 29th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this two-day conference features two concurrent CE tracks for both PCAs and CCAs. Earn the DPR and CCA credits you need. Network on our trade show floor and join us in giving away scholarships and honorariums presented by Western Region CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Visit progressivecrop.com/conference.
In national agricultural news, Senators Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin and Joni Ernst of Iowa have introduced bipartisan legislation to protect and expand access to high-speed internet in rural communities and encourage rural broadband investment. The Access to Capital Creates Economic Strength and Supports Rural America Act would provide regulatory relief to rural telecommunications service providers by allowing them to submit streamlined financial reports to the Securities and Exchange Commission. These small businesses are often the only service providers in their regions and could be put out of business by looming regulatory costs. The Access Rural America Act would save small businesses from costly SEC reporting requirements that were never intended for them. Reliable high-speed broadband is essential to rural families, students, and farmers, according to Baldwin. Unfortunately, rural telecom companies are getting hit with costly reporting fees that are intended for much larger companies, threatening to upend their businesses and halt their service to the communities. Climate change emission reductions are the biggest part of the Senate passed Inflation Reduction Act, now headed for expected House action tomorrow, and the debate over cost and impact is heating up. The bill would spend nearly $370 billion on tax breaks to spur renewables like biofuels, electric vehicle purchases, and home energy efficiencies, plus billions more on climate smart ag like the Environmental Quality Incentives Program. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says it's one of the largest investments ever in climate.
By our analysis, this bill will cut greenhouse gas emissions by approximately 40% by 2030. That's a lot.
Senate GOP leader Mitch McConnell argues it's a waste of money, won't work, and is not politically popular.
The Democrats' focus is Green New Deal nonsense that only 3% of the country wants prioritized. Big subsidies to help rich people buy luxury cars and new stoves. Taxpayer funding for environmental protesters. A huge catalog of nonsense that would not put a dent in global emissions while countries like China continue to emit more and more.
China announced it was breaking off cooperation with the U.S. on climate change after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan. But Democrats say the U.S. must lead on climate and aim for the skies to help reduce climate disasters and improve health.
Our clean energy proposals will reduce air pollution, prevent thousands of needless deaths each year, and reduce asthma attacks by 100,000 per year. We've all seen kids, often in poor neighborhoods, struggling with asthma.
Once again, the House is expected to take up the Inflation Reduction Act tomorrow. With key moderates on board, Democrats seem likely to pass it. And data is playing a role in strengthening the resiliency of local and regional food systems. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain has the story.
Data, an essential tool for any business. Yet how is it being used to help businesses create more resilient local and regional food systems, and in turn, more connected supply chains? Or as Colorado State University's Lillian Breslin puts another way,
how can we, as folks interested in data and local regional food systems, best engage our stakeholders to ensure accuracy and relevancy and transparency of our data and metrics work?
Breslin hosted a panel on leveraging data for local and regional food systems at this year's USDA Agricultural Outlook Forum. Hillary King of Emory University at Community Farmers Markets discusses how farmers market managers collect and use data to make decisions.
So thinking about qualitative and quantitative metrics and then putting those data into conversation with each other. So many things are data, both kind of attendance counts at markets that can be turned into specific numbers, but also market managers' qualitative observations around how vendors get along with each other or what map placements should look like that impact everybody's sales over time.
What about correlating data for use in farm to institution supply chains? Think local growers to their community or regional schools, hospitals, or senior centers. As Lacey Stevens of the National Farm to School Network explains, that includes
utilize and follow closely the USDA Farm to School Census data. We conduct our own National Farm to Early Care and Education surveys to look at purchasing practices. And then we do a lot of work in supporting our partners and being able to use that data within their own planning and their own policy work. We also do some specific work around evaluating policies, state level policies specifically around local procurement practices, aggregating data from state agencies and local partners to really get a big picture about impact around policies.
Technical assistance to local and regional food systems is another way data is used. Colorado State University Extension Specialist Becca Jablonski offers an example of how Cooperative Extension utilizes USDA in such assistance.
From a project that was actually funded by the USDA Ag Marketing Service a bunch of years ago, where we have looked at profitability and expenditures by market channel. And the reason we do this is that a lot of times producers are tracking their sales by market, but they're sort of lumping those expenses together. And so they really don't understand, for example, that maybe one farmer's market that they're selling at is much more profitable than another market. And until not too long ago, those type of data really weren't available when we started collecting it actually through a project that a colleague led at Cornell University. We call them market channel assessment data.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, supporting the industry with on-farm innovation through production research, advocacy for government programs, and driving consumer demand. Doing more together.
Because of the way winter precipitation fell this year, the Sacramento Valley is a land of the haves and have-nots. David Guy, president of the Northern California Water Association, describes the west side of the valley as being brown, while the east side is much greener.
Boy, I mean, we really have a disparate dry year system this year. The storms all missed the west side of the valley, including the Lake Shasta watershed. So the west side of the valley has little to no water, whereas the east side of the Sacramento Valley, because of the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada, at least has some water this year. So when you fly over the valley, the west side of the valley is brown, and the east side of the valley is pretty green. Very different dynamic as you go across the valley this year.
This disparity in water supplies has translated into thousands of acres of agricultural land going unplanted on the west side. Guy said agriculture on the east side is faring better, with growers able to plant some acreage.
Well, the farmers on the west side of the valley, where there's really no water, are receiving anywhere from probably 0 to 15% of their water this year. Some have groundwater availability, but most of them don't. So you've really just seen a lot of land left fallow. For context, on the west side of the valley this year, you basically have 600 square miles of farmland that is fallow. That's about 375,000 acres that is fallow, and that's about 80% of the farmland within that kind of service area. On the east side of the valley, you at least in some areas have 50% of the supply available, so much better, and people are able to stretch that 50% and use some groundwater, so that we're at least seeing some farming on the east side of the valley. But on the west side of the valley, you have trees that are obviously need water every year to survive, but most of the other crops have been left fallow this year.
The drought's impact, particularly on the west side, has trickled down to the communities. Guy said some of the hardest hit businesses are tied to agriculture, such as the chemical dealers and equipment dealers. In July, UC Davis agroeconomists Daniel Sumner and William Matthews released a report looking at the drought's impact on the Sacramento Valley economy. In that report, they project direct farm and ranch impacts of $950 million for 2022. Taking in allied ag industries, they forecast $1.3 billion in losses for this year alone.
Boy, things are really rough on the west side of the valley this year, particularly in Glenn and Colusa counties. You just really see lots of impacts to, of course, not only the farmers, but then more, you know, most vividly, the communities are really suffering. All of the, of course, agricultural suppliers are suffering. And yeah, the numbers that Dr. Sumner has come up with, just to reiterate those, it is 14,300 jobs that are going to be lost, $1.3 billion in lost economic value, and then $732 million in lost labor income. It's going to be really hard on the west side of the valley, and people are really struggling to get through the year up there.
Water districts that serve the area also have been hit hard by the lack of water. Guy said, fortunately, they have reserves that provide some type of safety net. Nevertheless, he said they still are feeling the impacts.
It is. It's really hard on the water districts and the water companies who are working to provide water. Most districts and companies do have reserves to plan for these types of years, and obviously any unforeseen maintenance that comes along, which is pretty common, obviously, in trying to supply water. But yeah, this year is just really hard on the districts, and just every aspect of the community is being affected by the lack of water being served out on the ground.
On a positive note, Guy said he expects Sacramento Valley reservoirs to end the water year with about the same or slightly more water supplies than at the same time last year. The water year ends September 30th. At the same time, he said he expects groundwater levels to be lower because of the increased reliance on the underground supplies. With that in mind, Guy said water managers should try to maximize groundwater recharge when the rainy season starts this fall.
The good news is that we are at least the reservoirs are going to be at the end of the water year are going to be basically the same, or in some cases maybe even a little bit better than they were at the start of this year. So with respect to surface storage, which of course in these dry years, we end up really relying almost entirely on surface water storage. Thank God we have storage in California to really help. So the good news is we're starting the year at least in the same or at least a little bit better place. And then obviously we just have to pray for a precipitation. Converse is true for groundwater. The groundwater has been pumped obviously very hard this year and will continue to be pumped through the end of the irrigation season. So I think we can safely say that We're going to start the next water year with the groundwater reservoirs in worse condition than we started this year. So I think a lot of what we're trying to figure out is how to best prepare for next year with that dynamic in mind. And of course, that means we're going to try to recharge every drop of surface water that we can. It means we're going to be able to hopefully be able to put wells in some strategic locations to give some options for better water management. And then obviously we'll just hope for a normal precipitation pattern next year that fills up the reservoirs.
The state has talked about building Sites Reservoir in Glenn and Colusa counties since at least the 1980s. The off-stream facilities would capture peak flows during the winter and store up to 1.5 million acre-feet of water until the summer. Then it would help supply farmers, urban users, and the environment. Had Sites been in place this year, Guy said the Sacramento Valley situation would be vastly different. He cited as an example Diamond Valley Lake, which provides up to 800,000 acre-feet of water to the Los Angeles Basin. It is located near Hemet.
Boy, wouldn't it be nice to have Sites Reservoir right now? You know, Sites Reservoir obviously, you know, would have 500 to a million acre-feet of water in it this year. That would sure be nice to be able to access this year. I think the best analogy to kind of give some context to that is we have Diamond Valley Reservoir east of Los Angeles that Metropolitan Water District built almost a decade ago. And obviously Southern California is suffering from the Colorado River drought. They're suffering from the State Water Project and all their other supplies. And thank God they have water in Diamond Valley this year. That is really what is getting Southern California through this year and maybe next. So if you think about that in the context of Northern California, it's the same dynamic. Man, if we had water in Sites Reservoir, that would be a real blessing for the North State, for the environment, for the whole entire state. So we need Sites Reservoir.
Whether 2023 is a repeat of 2022 in terms of water is anyone's guess. But at least we can all do what some water district yard signs have pleaded: pray for rain. This is Vicki Boyd reporting for My Ag Life.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
That will wrap up today's show. You've been listening to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer. From all of us here at the JCS Marketing Team, thank you for listening.